Eliza was content with her life, helping her blind father, repairing clocks, and running her ladies' gossip magazine. But when the visit of a foreign prince to London throws her into the middle of a mystery, it's all that she can do to keep her heart safe. I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to another episode. This week, we are going to get into an adventure today with a surprise selection from Harlequin Historical. I say this is a surprise because, and I am somewhat ashamed to admit this, I didn't know this novel came from Harlequin at all when I purchased it. I was doing another round of book purchases when I came across The Princess Plan by Julia London. Because I was shopping in an online environment, I'm not seeing things the way I would normally see them in the bookstore. Most notably, the spine. If I had seen that on a shelf, I'd have seen the Harlequin logo with the historical imprint. I'd like to think that I could be forgiven this oversight, however, considering that this is an older novel from Harlequin. It was published in November of 2019 as the first of London's A Royal Wedding series, and the cover carries none of the expected Harlequin historical branding that we are familiar with today. Something that really sticks out is a special insert page right behind the cover. I'll get to the cover in a moment, but this is something we haven't seen before. It's a picture of our supposed couple, locked in an embrace, partly clothed, and it's assumed that they are about to get down. It surprised me when I saw it, that's for sure. Now we can get into the book proper and look at that cover. Our cover is pretty straightforward. We have a blonde woman looking out at us, wearing a fancy blue ball gown, standing in what I think is a very fancy entryway. I am assuming it's an entryway with those ornate doors. Everything has a bluish-purple tint, and the title is printed in raised silver letters. It's all very elegant. Except there is one huge, glaring problem. Remember that this novel is listed as historical, and I had absolutely no clue that it was. A big reason for this was this cover. It's beautiful, of course, but the woman's dress? Well, I asked two separate people what they thought of this dress, and they said that it looked like an early 2000s prom dress. Our story takes place in 1845, in Victorian England. I am by no means a fashion historian, but I know a bad cover job when I see it. Now, you'd think that the back blurb would have also given me a clue, but it did not. It read like anything I might have found in Harlequin's Presents group. The only suspect word is gazette. Other than that, nothing indicated that I was about to pick up a Victorian romance. Our novel opens with the words London, 1845, which is what sent me into a spiral that had me questioning reality, and follows with what looks to be an excerpt from a news clipping. It describes a royal banquet meant to welcome a visiting prince, the Crown Prince Sebastian of Aleutia. This excerpt is finished with the words, Honeycutt's Gazette of Fashion and Domesticity for Ladies. Most of the chapters have beginnings like this. There's little excerpts from this gossip magazine, usually relevant to the story as it happens, and typically followed up with advice that a housewife might receive back in Victorian England. They're a fun way for the reader to immerse themselves into our world that the author is creating. We are introduced to Justice Tricklebank, an old gentleman nearly blind but still dutifully sitting on the bench in service to the Queen. He lives in his house with his daughter Eliza, a woman described as a spinster. Now, Eliza is only 28, but in Victoria-era England, that apparently meant she'd gone past her marriage expiration date. But she's got a good thing going. She's happy to help her father and spends quite a bit of time repairing clocks. On top of that, she is helping produce the Honeycutt Gazette with her sister, Hollis Honeycutt, who is herself a very young widow. From the looks of things, Eliza was set to marry someone, but clearly something fell through. But it doesn't look like it bothers her any, and she looks more or less content. We're seeing a lot of this through the judge's eyes and get a tiny bit of exposition about what's about to go down. Today, his daughters were in an unusually high state of excitement, for they had secured the highly sought-after invitations to the Duke of Marlborough's masquerade ball in honor of the Crown Prince of Aleutia. One would think that the world had stopped spinning on its axis, and that the heavens had parted, and that the seas had receded, and this veritable god of all royal princes has shined his countenance upon London and blessed them all with his presence. Hogwash. I wish we got more introductions like this. There's a little more exposition about Alusha itself, how it's trying to modernize, the conflict it's had with the neighboring country West Loria, and the trade deals the prince is trying to secure. But that's not the big news. The big news is that the prince was on the hunt for an English wife, someone to help tie the two countries together and become queen. That is what has the girls in a tizzy today. They were able to get their invitations through a friend of theirs, Caroline Hawke. Caroline, or Caro as they call her, seems to have all the latest hot goss, and I suppose she is a reliable source for the Honeycutt Gazette. Now at the ball, we find Eliza in a receiving line to meet a prince of Alusha. We see that the Alushan envoy has dressed their men all in identical clothing and masks, so one may not pick out the crown prince from his entourage. As she's waiting, she remembers a strange encounter with one of these identical masked men. When she arrived at the ball, she was almost immediately separated from her sister and Caro, and found herself distracted and enchanted by all the glamour around her. Until, that is, she is found by a ballroom hostess, a woman whose sole job it was to make sure all the women had dance partners. In order to escape, Eliza ducked into a servant's hallway. Obviously, as she is not supposed to be there, she convinces a passing server that she just needed some air, and he hands her a rum punch, which apparently is the best thing on earth. After the server leaves, she hears voices speaking the Alushan language, and she suddenly finds herself face to face and alone with one of the masked men. She breaks the awkward silence with an attempt at conversation. She even performs a small microaggression where she does the thing that white people do when talking to foreigners. You know, almost yelling, "Do you speak English?" in an insultingly slow pace. He responds that yes, he speaks English, and after another awkward moment of conversation, another server walks up and supplies Eliza with, yes, another rum punch. This time she's generous and insists that he takes a sip. But the gentleman surprised her. He took the glass, his fingers brushing against hers. She watched with fascination as he put the glass to his lips and sipped the punch. He removed a handkerchief from his coat pocket, wiped the glass where his lips had touched it, and handed it back to her. "Yea, it is very good." I do want to be clear that I have got no idea how to pronounce "yea" written as J-E. I'm going with a more German approach, pronouncing the J as I would in Jaeger. And this is something that I see a lot in these international romances. They imply that there is a unique language to these fictional European kingdoms, and they only ever create translations for two words, yes and God. Now, I am not going to drag these authors for not going full J.R.R. Tolkien and creating a whole new language from scratch for short and sweet romance novels, but I just find it so interesting that they always imply A, that their fictional kingdom has a fictional language, and B, never go beyond those two particular words. Well, they might use no, but I see yes far more often. They also tend to either borrow or straight-up steal Latin-based words. Dios and its variations are quite popular as an example. Back to our couple, however. Eliza flirts with the stranger, and she can tell that he is most certainly coming on to her. But before they can really get into it, someone comes to get the stranger, leaving Eliza alone. In her attempts to avoid the ballroom hostess, she accidentally ends up in the receiving line to meet the Crown Prince of Alusha, which is how she got to where we first found her. We watch as she verbally spars with someone in front of her, who is clearly agitated that Eliza was standing in a line that she had no business being in. As they get closer to the prince, Eliza realizes that, with a jolt, this was the man in the hallway. And no wonder that there were a gaggle of young women being lined up to see him, because the rumors had mentioned that he was looking for a marriage match. Eliza mentally names her present nemesis the Peacock, and daydreams about the prince meeting her acquaintance and asking her for a dance. Right as the Peacock is about to make her own statement, the prince has to go, well, who knows where. At a loss of what to do, Eliza, emboldened by the copious amounts of rum punch she had enjoyed, steps forward and loudly declares, "Welcome to England!" Unfortunately, this lands Eliza right into the prince's path, and he inadvertently steps on her foot. She is too elated to care, and regales her friends with the story when they find each other again. Now we get to see the story from Sebastian's eyes. He is not having a fantastic time at the ball. He'd much rather be pursuing his own interests. But duty calls, and he goes where he is asked for the sake of diplomacy. We can gather that this guy is under a level of protection that would be on par with our modern Secret Service. I'm guessing that we have the tensions between Alusha and Westloria to thank for that. The idea of the masquerade had come from Sebastian's secretary, Mateos Reno, a man that Sebastian trusted above all. He'd long been the prince's confidant, and this was a big deal, since it seems no one could really trust anyone in the Aleutian court. Sebastian didn't seem to have as dark an outlook, but still. And now Sebastian can blend in with his entourage of identical masks. Mateos goes above and beyond his basic assistance duties, and is able to help Sebastian relax with some punch and the promise of a few private moments with a charming woman, Miss Forsyth. When I say private, I do mean private. They've already met once before, and Forsyth is just so lonely when her husband is away in India. By the end of the night, they rendezvous in a room set aside for this exact purpose. But just before Sebastian can really let himself go, Mateus asks if they might have a word. Sebastian insists that it can wait, and he goes to avail himself of the pleasures Miss Forsyth is offering. I really do wonder at this sort of thing, where we see the hero get with a woman who is not our romantic intended. I suspect that is something in common with the dead woman trope. We haven't seen that particular trope in a while, thank goodness. But one possible use of dead women is to prove that our hero is a safe and caring partner. He had someone he loved and cared for dearly, so the evidence that he's safe is clear in his past. While Miss Forsyth isn't dead, obviously, she offers us a similar comfort. She sees Sebastian positively enough to have sex with him, and she's really only available if Sebastian asks for her company. Though I do want to take a moment to point out the glaring hypocrisy of the English marriage mart, where men can get into whatever shenanigans they like, but the moment a woman even looks at a man the wrong way, she is ruined. It's stupid. The next morning, Sebastian starts his day a little slowly. After a bath, he is joined for breakfast by his field marshal, Rostafan, and his foreign minister, Caius. They start to discuss matters of state, but Sebastian needs Mateus present to discuss such things. He sends a butler to wake him up, but the man returns, clearly shaken. Mateus has had his throat cut in his sleep. Sebastian is near inconsolable, outraged that this had happened, and felt regret as he remembered that there was something Mateus needed to tell him. Something was wrong, and now he needed to find out what. We then see Eliza, Caro, and Hollis happily gossiping away over the previous night's festivities. That's where Caro's brother, Lord Hawk, arrives to give them the gossip of his own. First, he swears them all to pure secrecy, ensuring that it won't be printed in the Honeycutt Gazette. Then he tells them of the murder. A few days pass, I think, and the girls have mostly kept quiet on the Gazette as far as that ball went. But one day, Eliza receives an anonymous note tucked away in their daily mail that changes everything. Imagine Sebastian's surprise to see the rumor printed in this lady's gossip magazine. I'll admit to not seeing it initially, but Sebastian sure does, and it looks like Rostafan is a supposed suspect. The prince gets as much information as he can about the Gazette, and despite literally everyone telling him otherwise, he insists on speaking to the publisher. He drags his brother Leopold with him, and they soon find themselves in Eliza's house. Except they don't know that it's Eliza that they're looking for. They believe the Gazette is written by the judge, so they've come to see him. However, the judge was currently sleeping, and it's clear that Eliza is very protective of her father. After their unceremonious entrance into her modest home, mistaking her for the housekeeper, and demanding that she wake up her father, Eliza has had it. Eliza was taken aback. She'd never cared for the way men thought that by virtue of their sex they were superior to women and could simply order them around and tell them what to do. She couldn't count how many gentlemen had been in this very parlor to call on her father, and thought it quite all right to tell her what to do. some tea, Miss Tricklebank, or fetch your father's lap rug, Miss Tricklebank, or I'll have a port, Miss Tricklebank. But this was her house, and she could refuse whatever she liked. I beg your pardon, sir, but my father is blind, and does not sleep through the night as you or and I would, as he cannot sense the time. He needs his rest. I've certainly noticed a trend when it comes to these historical novels. We need to have that girl power moment to help us align our modern sensibilities for those not-so-progressive bygone eras. I'm certainly not a historian on women's rights, but I don't mind these moments, so long as they're not over the top, and they aren't repeatedly thrown at us. Sebastian meets her challenge, and attempts to get his way by intimidating her, which only pisses her off all the more. She promptly throws them out of her house, and enjoys the adrenaline rush that might follow the sensation of having thrown out visiting royalty. Later on, Eliza is regaling Hollis and Caro with the story of the rude royals, and they start to discuss the intrigue surrounding the murder. One suspect they have in mind is a man that they saw talking with the victim. Even though everyone wore masks, both gentlemen were quite distinctive. Matthias had a unique hand appearance, and the man he was speaking with, John Heath, was a governor of the Bank of England, and he had a, large stature. The only thing that they weren't sure of was what the two men were talking about. As Caro happened to be acquainted with John Heath's daughter, the girls wonder if Caro could invite her to tea and see what she might know. I will take a moment to mention that this novel is quite a bit chunkier than most of the Harlequins we see these days. Most range about 280 pages. The Princess Plan is about 380, so there's a lot going on that I'm sort of skipping over. Unfortunately, I'm caught in this strange place of appreciating the detail taken in the novel versus the amount of time it's being taken with. I really do appreciate that the author is giving us so much to work with, but for some reason I'm tired. I'm having a hard time keeping names and facts straight, and that's not good for what is essentially a mystery novel. I'm not sure if the problem is me. Am I too distracted to fully immerse myself in the story, or has the novel failed to keep my attention? Perhaps the length itself makes the novel tedious. Maybe after the Lady Emily series, I'm already burnt down on Victorian mysteries. Maybe I'm resentful of the fact that I didn't want to read a Victorian mystery when I picked up this book. Maybe I'm just whiny. But do keep in mind that there are lots of small details here, and that they simply aren't making it into the review. Sebastian and Leopold return to the guest palace, as I am now calling it, and Sebastian is practically seething with the audacity that some commoner woman dared to speak to him the way Eliza Tricklebank dared. The next day, it becomes clear that the investigation is not moving in any satisfying direction. Sebastian tells Leo that he is going back to the judge's house. His brother tells him that he's insane, but Sebastian doesn't care. He goes to Eliza's house, and when she opens the door, he promptly apologizes. He tells her that he's got no excuse for his behavior, other than the fact that he had lost a close and personal friend. This softens Eliza a bit, and she welcomes him inside. There's a little bit of back and forth, with Sebastian still thinking that the judge is still responsible for the Gazette, until Eliza comes clean with her involvement. She tells him that she received a note among their mail, delivered by a man who wasn't their usual postman. Sebastian asks if he can see the note, but Eliza and Poppy, her maid, go on about possible reasons for having been sent the note in the first place. The entire time this is going down, and whenever Sebastian has been in this house, we've gotten a taste of his absolute befuddlement at the state of the house. From the copious books everywhere, to the clocks, to Poppy taking tea with both of them during his visit, he is completely bewildered. I won't say that there's a hint of resentment, maybe unease, but at least it's not the absolute disgust that we've seen some princes exhibit in other novels. I have to say, though, it doesn't exactly endear me to Sebastian. It might tell me that he's very far removed from his people, or at least his average subject. Just because he's the crown prince, it shouldn't mean that he's unaware of how the middle class might live. It's not just his surroundings that are sending him into a tizzy, either. Eliza is proving to be perhaps the strangest woman he's ever spoken to. He finally gets her to tell exactly what the note said, how it was written, and where she took the note since she no longer had it. She also told him that Matthias was seen with the banker, Mr. Heath, and that she will be having tea with his daughter to further investigate. Eventually, Sebastian leaves, and even though he was annoyed to the point of exasperation with Eliza's antics, he realized how relieved he felt that he spoke with someone at length who didn't treat him the way one would expect to be treated as a crown prince. The day of the tea arrives, and Eliza decides to walk to Caro's for the tea time, but she's intercepted by Sebastian, who insists on accompanying her. He tries to get her to take a carriage, but she's stubborn as ever and declines. Amusingly, they talk about the ball, and she reminds him that she met him in the hallway, where it's revealed that he had not put two and two together yet. The wind picks up, and Sebastian steadies Eliza by oh-so-scandalously putting his hand on the small of her back. He removed his hand at once, of course, and when she turned to look at him, those lovely green eyes were on hers, the color deeper and darker somehow. She noticed his square jaw, his full lips the color of dark rose. She had this fleeting question of what it would be like to kiss those lips, followed by a general curiosity of what they would taste like, and then a more pressing curiosity of how passionately those lips might descend on her lips, or against the skin of her neck, her arm, her throat, and everywhere else, points low and high. So this is where we start seeing some possible romance start to bloom. Sebastian having been charmed by her eccentricity, and Eliza enchanted by his looks, I guess? But as time goes on, it is clear that she is starting to see the sweeter side of him, the side of him that would like to take a break from all his royal responsibilities, and the side that wants justice for the death of his friend. They arrive at Caro's home, and Eliza goes inside, ready to face, well, whatever needs to be faced. Sebastian promised to wait for her, since she said that she'd only be an hour, and as he's waiting, he's coming to terms with the fact that he has done a complete 180 on his perception of Miss Eliza Tricklebank. When she finally emerges, it had started to rain, so he quickly catches up with her and gets her into a carriage. She does oblige him this time, and tells him what she discovered. She tells him that his friend must have had a large debt, because he had spoken to Mr. Heath about getting in touch with a French banker who was currently staying in England. Sebastian questions this only because he knew that Matthias was quite wealthy, so that didn't add up. When he returns to the palace, he calls upon his marshal Caius and asks for him to discreetly investigate if Rostefan has any outstanding debts. Caius agrees and also makes a suggestion. Sebastian was in need of a secretary since Matthias's murder, so Caius recommended that the prince hire his wife, Serafina, at least until they return to Alusia. A few clues have been laying around that might cast Caius in a suspicious light. This is one of those moments. I knew that I couldn't trust the Serafina, though, and I sure wasn't going to go back on that suspicion. 2 days later, Caius informs Sebastian that Rostefan didn't have any debts, but he sure did come into a large amount of money. Why was he looking to move money quietly? We really can't be sure yet. We catch up with Eliza as she spills the deets with Caro and Hollis, thinking herself that she has quite liked the prince's company. We see in a flashback how, 10 years ago, she had been preparing to marry another man who had promised himself to her, only to find that he had offered engagement to another woman. Devastated by this betrayal, she had not been keen to find another match after this, and thus ended up a spinster, but now here she was, pining after Prince Sebastian. While they all gossip away about who might marry whom this season, there's a knock at the door, and there Eliza finds the crown prince once again outside her door. Of course, this sends Caro and Hollis near into a fit, which isn't helped when Sebastian asks to speak to Eliza privately. He tells her what he discovered, that Rostefan was the one with the strange financial situation, and Eliza suggests that perhaps it was a different sort of debt, one that didn't involve the money. Though they really can't be sure, and Sebastian knows that he needs to talk to the banker. Eliza tells him that he can't go to Mr. Heath directly. That won't end well, but she can perhaps arrange a dinner in which Sebastian would find himself in the same room with Mr. Heath. She also tells him that she'll keep an eye out for the man who left the note, and shrugs off Sebastian's urges to not do that. To add to the seriousness of his request, Sebastian leans in for a kiss. He deepened the kiss, still soft but insistent, easy but demanding. She was feeling things cracking open, things she'd not felt properly in a very long time. She was sparkling. Blood and bone were sparkling in her, and the heat was running a course over and over in her, down to her toes and fingers and up again, to her head and her heart. After the kiss, which makes Eliza apparently feel like she's been burned on a pyre, Sebastian leaves with only a simple goodbye. When he returns to the guest palace, he's really thinking about how Eliza makes him feel. He asks his butler to create a scenario in which he could have a dinner with the strongest possible privacy, and we are left to infer that he wants to be able to dine with Eliza without setting London ablaze with gossip. At least that's what I inferred. It is possible something flew miles above my head. Back with Eliza, her friends are positively thrilled. She'd had her magical kiss, but Kara starts to wonder why Eliza is still so focused on solving the murder. She got some once-in-a-lifetime attention from an actual royal prince. Surely now she must be ready to move on. I can't tell if the author is having a fourth-wall moment here or not, but it's amusing to watch her character spell out what's happening and calling the whole thing ridiculous. Because, well, it kind of is, but that doesn't mean we can't have fun with it. Eliza was still relying on Caro to help arrange an event or dinner where Sebastian might casually run into Mr. Heath, but it seems to be a tall order even for her. However, Caro's brother Beck comes in to tell them that he and Caro have been invited to a birthday celebration for a young woman who I think was about to enter into her first season. Apparently, everyone who is everyone will be there, including Mr. Heath and, supposedly, the Aleutian princes. Sebastian didn't exactly want to go, but the girl's father was a member of Parliament and thus a potential ally when it came to the trade agreement between Aleutia and England. And furthermore, he still needed to make a choice of the woman he would marry to help strengthen political alliances. Thus, a party to meet potential matches and their powerful fathers was a necessity. While he schmoozes at the party, Sebastian was thrilled to find that Eliza had managed to come to this particular party. When he's finally able to wrest himself away from eager politicians and hopeful women, he manages to ask Eliza to a dance. They have an enchanting waltz, Sebastian calls her beautiful, and Eliza points out that Mr. Heath is right over there when their dance is over. Sebastian is able to get confirmation from Mr. Heath that Matthias was indeed inquiring about a debt to be paid, about a great deal of money being transferred from the Bank of England to a French bank. Now, it's certain that Matthias wasn't trying to get this done for himself, but Mr. Heath was unaware of who Matthias was speaking for or about. Now Eliza is having a grand old time at this party. She's had a dance with the prince, she's enjoying her rum punch, and she is just as happy as she can be. Right up until she sees the man who had once courted her before dumping her for a woman with more money. She's determined not to let it sour her spirits, and that lasts right up to the moment she sees Sebastian dancing with a woman, the one Eliza had dubbed the peacock at the first masquerade ball. Her name is Lady Catherine, and she comes from a good family, likely has a large dowry, and is on the top of all the gossip to be the woman Sebastian will choose to marry. It's all a bit much for Eliza. She knew it couldn't last forever, but she attempts to content herself with the moments they've already shared, and with rum punch. But before she loses all hope, a stranger brings her a message, telling her to wait for the prince to send word. Perhaps all is not yet lost. I don't know if this is cliché exactly, but I do like the plotline of someone getting involved with royalty, knowing full well their romance can't amount to anything official. There's something about the angst of our heroine watching the man she is desperately trying not to fall in love with, having to court someone you know that they would have to choose purely for politics. Eliza's loved ones are right to worry about her. It will do her no good to have her heart broken by an impossible love. Sebastian got the details all settled for his private dinner, and after getting a scolding from his brother to pick a match already, he goes to meet with Eliza. I'm not seeing the same sort of romantic angst from Sebastian. Rather, he knows that he'll have to marry someone suitable, but he's not ready to let go of his friendship with Eliza. She's one of the very few people around him that treats him like a person, not a prince. She innocently asks him if he wanted to see her to talk about the banker. Befuddled once again, he tells her no, he wants to talk to her. She laughs herself silly, saying that she almost convinced herself that he was about to make a marriage proposal. I really do have to say, our couple has a lot of chemistry. The banter between them feels realistic, and I can clearly see their attraction growing every time they get together. This dinner is where that chemistry shines. They get to sit down together and actually talk so they can know one another. They both explain to the other why they haven't been married by now, and they can hear each other's stories. And as they grow closer emotionally, they can become closer physically. Her skirt and petticoat was bunched between them. She held him in her arms, her fingers clawing down his back as he stroked her with his hand. If she hadn't been incinerated by the burn in her veins, Eliza might have laughed at their inglorious and frantic arrangement. But she turned to ash, and there was nothing she could think of, nothing she wanted more than this man. It was so urgent between them, so much overwrought attraction and desire boiling between them, that it couldn't come fast enough. For all my qualms, I have to admit that a fair few of the Harlequin authors have managed to skirt the line between romantic and erotic. While they might not use the more descriptive language of saucier fare, we can still experience the frantic passion that our characters are expressing. It's for a brief moment, but Eliza feels as though a weight was lifted off of her, basking in this moment with Sebastian. But she knows that she'll be in trouble when eventually the end must come to their arrangement. Sebastian is loath to see Eliza go, but he promises her that he will see her again, and he finds himself caught between the dilemma of loving her and having to marry a stranger. His mood is thoroughly soured when he finds Serafina in his rooms for some reason, and then sees Rostefan barge in after she had left. Sebastian is not happy that people are coming into his quarters without permission, implying that they were in his rooms hoping he wouldn't be there. Something's afoot, if we didn't already know. Time is running out for Sebastian now. He's been presented with the top two choices of a marriage match, and in 3 days, he'd sit down at a dinner with both families. He sees it as the beginning of the end of his time with Eliza. He tells himself that it has to be like this, but that doesn't mean that he has to like it. Later on, Eliza is out running errands at the market, when she happens to see someone familiar. It's the man that she saw delivering the mail, the day the mysterious note had been delivered. She catches up with him, and while he's reluctant to speak with her, he tells her that it was a woman with an accent who had handed him the mail, and instructed him to take it to Judge Tricklebank's house. When she arrives home, who else is waiting for her there but Sebastian? He's come to talk to her again, but this time he sticks around to make her father's acquaintance. They are joined by Hollis, and they are all sitting together for a quick glass of whiskey. It is both awkward and hilarious. Finally, Sebastian asks to speak to Eliza privately, and she's able to tell him about her encounter at the market. Sebastian isn't sure what to make of the mystery woman, but without a solid ID, not much can be done. Before he leaves, Eliza gives him a pocket watch that she repaired, engraved with the Latin words, Amor Loyal. She tells him that when she saw it, she thought of him. He tells her that he needs to leave and return to the guest palace, and why. He wanted to be the one that let her know that he was dining with marital prospects, instead of hearing it through the grapevine. As he leaves, she seems to take it in stride, thankful for the last few weeks of adventure and friendship. Sebastian goes to the dinner, and rumor gets out that he'd chosen Lady Catherine, the peacock. This bit of gossip is all the talk around Eliza's house and in the market when she goes out again. But while she's out, she's approached by a stranger who asks to meet with a friend. He shows her the pocket watch that she gave Sebastian as a means of proving no harm, and telling her that he's a guard in the prince's service. He takes her to see Sebastian, and after their hellos, she asks about the rumor. He insists that he's not made any choice, and he has no idea where people got the idea. He hasn't made a choice, you see, because he has fallen in love with someone who has made the choice impossible. Eliza meekly denies that he feels actual love for her, but she doesn't resist for long. And she also doesn't resist any physical advances either. She doesn't care that it'll hurt her later, she only cares about now. It's another desperate, frantic lovemaking, but that's not surprising given the circumstances. And it's not much different from the last tryst of theirs, except maybe Sebastian managed to get them to an actual bed this time. What is interesting is the method of birth control. Okay, bear with me here. So, in lots of these Harlequin books, if the sex is on the more descriptive side or featured at all, they always, always make a mention of condoms. Every time. And that's good. It's good to see representations of safe sex in modern media. But our story takes place in 1845. Condoms did exist, but they were expensive and unreliable to boot. The first rubber condom would be made in 1855, so it's not possible for the usual he sheathed himself with a condom that we see in so many of these Harlequins. So what's a prince to do? Why, employ the pull-out method, of course? I don't think I need to explain that this is bad. It doesn't protect from STDs, and the protection from pregnancy it offers is negligible. Pull-out doesn't work, full stop. But this is Harlequin, and I guess we can't have ejaculation without mentioning some form of birth control. Unprotected sex that might give our heroine an STD is fine, but don't make her pregnant. With the amount of pregnancy stories that Harlequin pumps out, they really aren't being consistent with their messaging. Anyway, after Sebastian and Eliza have enjoyed themselves, Eliza asks if Sebastian has made any progress with the information that she gave him. When he tells her no, she gets the brilliant idea to take him to the market, and they find the guy to get more information. Amazingly, they manage to track him down, and he's just as jittery as the first time Eliza found him. Sebastian offers him an extravagant £20 to look at some faces for the next day from a coach. The man agrees, saying that he'll do it for 10, and off he goes. They meet up at the promised time, and the man points out Serafina with all certainty as Sebastian talks with a bunch of women from his entourage. When Eliza tells Sebastian, she mentions that she had met Serafina at the birthday ball with her husband. But when she describes the man, it's clear that whoever it wasn't Caius. Eliza returns home, and she doesn't hear from Sebastian for some time. 3 days have gone by when the rumor mill has ground up some new fodder. There had been a plot to kidnap Prince Sebastian, and when Mateus had gotten wind of it, he had been murdered for his trouble. Faced with this news, Eliza says that she has to go see him, somehow, and rushes to the house where she and Sebastian had their clandestine meetings, only to find it empty and the curtains drawn. I'm not sure if this counts as third act separation. I'm leaning towards no, but we still have our hero and heroine taken apart by whatever circumstances. But it's not a breakup, and it's not a misunderstanding. It's just politics and social structures. If it does count, it's one of the very few that I'm going to tolerate. Sebastian is able to get the full confession from Serafina. She was indeed collaborating with the Field Marshal Rostefan to help concoct the kidnapping scheme, and apparently it was her who had slashed Mateus's neck as he slept. She'd become riddled with guilt, and hoping to take suspicion off of her, she slipped the note to Eliza's father implicating Rostefan. When that had all been settled, now it was finally time to finish up trade negotiations and to choose a wife. Sebastian knows that he only wants Eliza, but her status wouldn't permit it, so he comes up with a plan. There's a legal question involving the trade agreement, and Sebastian will ask Judge Tricklebank to rule on it, and in exchange for his assistance, he will be given a title, which would then extend to his unwed daughter. That's the gist, anyway. I'm not fully invested in the political side of things right now. Back at Eliza's house, she goes on about her days as best as she can. Her father mentioned something that came to his bench, something about the tariffs involved in the trade agreement. Eliza is only half listening, working hard to ignore her heartbreak, but she sees a letter that had been neglected in the mail, which read only, "Amor loyal." As she's pondering on what Sebastian was trying to say to her, a colleague of her father arrives, and he has Sebastian in tow. He's come to explain that he won't leave London without her, and asks for her hand in marriage. Our final chapter gives us a vision of Eliza accompanied by her friends and her sister, arriving in Alusha to begin the next adventure. And that is where the princess plan leaves us. What did we think? If I'm being honest, it's a good story, well written, but like I mentioned before, I couldn't really fully invest myself in this plot. I'm convinced that this is most likely a me problem, and I'd like to be as unbiased as I can as we take a look at Heather's final score. Alright, let's get to going with that cover. That is going to get a 1 out of 5. I make no apologies for this. Yes, it's a lovely cover, dominated by my favorite color, and it doesn't look like it was thrown together in 5 minutes. Even though I'm convinced that the dress is a Frankenstein monstrosity made from 3 other gowns, it's not obvious. But it's the dress that drags the score as low as it is. This is a Victorian romance. That is not a Victorian gown. Someone just told the cover artist that it's about a woman who becomes a princess, and gave no other instruction. It is the lack of care that brings everything down. Drama is going to be a 4 out of 5. There was a lot on the line here. Trade deals, murder mystery, and the strained romance between two people from very different social classes. I do wish I was able to be more invested in the politicking that went around our central romance, though. For whatever reason, I just didn't have the energy to spend investing myself. But I will say that the possible third act separation, where a couple didn't know how they could be together instead of pushing each other away, is one of the few that I actually liked. Romance is another 4 out of 5. The progression of their relationship felt quite natural, and this is likely due to the length of the novel itself. We were able to see how Sebastian and Eliza changed their opinions on the other, and see how they felt about each other. Care and time were taken, and I'm all the more appreciative. Spice level is going to be a middle-of-the-road 3 out of 5. It is by no means particularly erotic, but it also didn't pull me out of the story with any potential blandness. It's simple, but effective. Realism is a little tough, but I'll give that a 3 out of 5 as well. There are parts that feel realistic. Certainly the descriptions of the parties and the balls and the social structure felt authentic. And I felt that the chemistry between all the characters, not just the romantic ones, blended seamlessly. Things get dicey when we hit the royalty stuff, but the outlandish kidnapping plots and political intrigue is what makes these stories fun. In all, I believe that The Princess Plan was a very lovely story. It certainly ticks all the romance novel boxes, and the way the narration guided us through a Victorian setting was natural and comforting. Personally, if you like the royal Victorian romance, I'd certainly give this one a good read. For my final score, The Princess Plan will get 4 Gossip Gazettes out of 5. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Yin Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.